We've got a Russ theme going on this morning. Our next speaker is Russ Weekly. Webstock really is Russ Weekly's fault. Russ started the Web Standards Group in Australia 3 years ago, and his model of people talking about web standards through the mailing list that he set up and educating each other and teaching and inspiring, and subsequently holding sort of regular meetings in local cities. I think they started off in Sydney, eight of them in a pub talking, and it's kind of led directly to this. Russ, and also along with Maxine Sheeran, who I think's here as well, was one of the organisers of Web Essentials, and it was a web conference held in Sydney in the past 2 years. And it was the first web standards focus conference, I think, anywhere in the world. And it showed people that we could do this. And it also showed people that you didn't have to be in America or in London or somewhere like that to do this. All of which, of course, probably makes Russ sound a tad stuffy and earnest. He's not. You're going to really enjoy this presentation. Russ Weekly, everyone.
That's better. Hi, everyone. Yes, I'm a tad stuffy and earnest and all that sort of thing. But worse than that, I'm actually a criminal. I should just, in full disclosure, let you know that I have a dim, dark past, and this is it. 5 years ago, I was an internet criminal. So that means that if you saw newspaper articles in those days, it would have said something like, Australian web designer, what is it, steals an Australian senator's child. And it all began because of a silly little flash game I started, which was, and if I could learn the way I'm going here. There's a guy called John Herron who was an Australian senator, and he was ironically the Aboriginal Affairs Minister. And he came out with a statement which said, this thing about stolen generations, it's just really not that big a deal, and Aboriginal people should just get over it and move on. And I remember, like a lot of people, I was quite angry at this, and I thought, well, Senator Herron has 10 children. What would it be like if I made a little game where you could steal Senator Herron's children? So I made this game, and then I got an email. This is the formula to let you know that I'm instituting procedures against you for defamation in the Supreme Court of Queensland, and we'll be tracking you down. So, like anyone, I was shit scared, and we took the site down for 10 minutes, then put it back up. But the interesting thing about this is, a lot of you might know a guy called Peter Firminger. Peter Firminger actually hosted this for me, this site which was going to be sued. So, of course, his ass was on the line, even though I'd built the game. And Peter said to me, what I can't understand is, how the hell did he find out so quickly? How did he find out that you built this game? And I said, I emailed him a link. Peter said, what the hell were you thinking? And I said, well, I want to know what he thought of the game. So there you have it. Now, I want to talk to you about someone who has much more cred. It's a girl called Lisa Miller. Now, why would I want to be rave about her? Because this thing I'm going to be talking about today is actually a joint venture between Lisa and I. Lisa and I both work at the Australian Museum. Well, now Lisa has moved on to greener pastures. But she has an honorary degree in guppies, believe it or not. She did a lot of studies on guppies and how they interact. And funnily enough, older males are more attractive than younger males in the guppies. And that may even be true in the real world as well. But that aside, she's a web researcher for the Australian Museum. She owns Red Queen, which some of you may have come across. And she's also moved on now to being a project manager for Red Square. A lot of red going on here. And she's a forward thinker, as opposed to me. I'm a backward thinker. In fact, if you think about it, I engage my brain, it's got one of those backward reverse beep, 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 but we won't go there. Now, I keep going the wrong way. This is about a journey. It sounds very religious, and of course, everything for me revolves around religion. But this journey that Lisa and I went on was using the Australian Museum website. And we had this pretentious little thing, which is to explore the ways that we could let users allow them control, or whatever it says. But the most important thing here is this journey that we're about to talk about may be relevant to you, it may not be relevant to you. Some people have heard it all before, some people may not have heard it all before. I'm not going to give you a solution here. I'm just going to tell you some of these ideas that we came across and the journey that we undertook. And if it's interesting, then that's cool. The first thing that happened was that when we embarked on this journey, we did it without judgment. So we did it in little steps, we took our time, and we did it without judgment. And I've worked in a lot of teams, as probably a lot of you have as well, and it's quite a rare thing to actually put an idea out there and not hammer it pretty quickly. Does that sound familiar? What about we do this? No, that's shit! Or, no, that's not going to work. It's very quick to rip things down. And what we had is this interesting journey where an idea was put forward, and then it was just left there for a little while, and we'd come back and pick at it. And if there was a problem, we wouldn't just hammer it. We'd just leave it there and discuss it little bits at a time until, you know, we could formulate a bit further. And I thought that was quite a rare thing because it allows us to really move forward without negativity. So it's quite a funny thing. But let's get on to the point of this. This is about the Australian Museum. Even though this is not official, I'm not here as an official employee, it's the backbone of where this journey began. The Australian Museum site is pretty big. It's got 115,000 files, 3,000 folders, 43,000 pages, 130 sections, 12 websites, and 4 portals, and a partridge in a pear tree. And it has some problems. Now, these probably won't be familiar. Hands up who controls a large website. Yeah? Do these sound familiar? Some of the content's hard to find? Now, I know on all of your websites, every bit of content's easy to find. Some of it's old. The front page doesn't represent the content. Is this ringing a bell? Some navigation's illogical. Content is dull. Funnily enough, if you put those words together, it makes the word horrid. It's quite weird, isn't it? So when people say, my website is horrid, what they're really saying is it's old, it's hard, it doesn't represent the content, it's illogical and it's dull. So yes, we had all these problems. And so the web team decided it was time for a change. And I'm not saying one morning we all got up and said, it's time for a change. That didn't happen. What we all, over time, we're all getting more and more pissed off with, and we said, it's got to happen. So at a point, we decided, let's get into this sort of thing. And we had these initial aims. And at that point, we were obsessed with this concept of portals because we had massive amounts of content and we wanted to break it up. And so our primary aim was to create a series of initial portals that allow users to get to the content more quickly and easily. Sounds like a good aim, doesn't it? Just one nod will do. Or a burp. So we began this process. And anyone who's a usability expert in the audience would be sort of being very proud now because we followed all the usability principles. We did a stock take. And then we did a card sort. In fact, we did 2 card sorts. We did a card sort using content and a card sort using tasks. Any usability people in the audience? Am I doing the right thing so far? Donna's nodding. Yeah, all going well. And then we decided on a range of portals. So had our little piles of cards. It's all going very well. And then we discussed names for them. And we wanted intuitive names for them. It's all sounding familiar. And then because we were good people, we actually tested the names. So we sent it out to users and we got the names tested. Unfortunately, with all this process, that's what we ended up with. 13 portals. Animals, fossils and dinosaurs, rocks and minerals, Indigenous Australia, online science, online features, kids' stuff, teachers in kids' stuff, visiting the museum, about the museum, behind the scenes collections and research. So, going well. How do we end up with so many portals? This may not be familiar to many of you, these sort of 3 things are going on here, because I know none of you have these problems, but there's this thing called legacy content. I know it's quite rare. And then these are other things that you probably never have to address, which is pressures about mirroring departments. None of you have that problem? No? And the other thing is in-house agendas. Now, I know that you guys are all, you know, you can do whatever you want. You don't have any pressure from in-house people. I know it's hard to believe. You just put yourself in my position for a second. We had pressures from in-house to do certain things. I know, it's shocking. So what we end up with is portal overload. We call it Portaloo, but portal overload will do. But the problem is, Lisa and I sat down and we said, this is not working out. We've got too many portals. There's a mixture of concepts. I don't know what you saw before, but there's some that are content-based, so you've got animals and stuff, and there's some that are user-based, so you had teachers and students. So you had this weird mix of portals. And as well as that, they didn't seem intuitive. There were points where the web team were arguing about something, and we could not, for the life of us, work out where to go. Now, of course, you can put things in multiple portals. That's not the point. The point is that they weren't intuitive. There were some things, even with 13 portals, that weren't intuitive, which is pretty sad, really, which says a lot maybe about our intellect, but also says something about this concept of portals. But we had a bigger problem. Our biggest concern was this concept of pathways. And what we were trying to work out is why these portals weren't working. And part of the problem is because they're based on inflexible pathways. We are actually deciding for the users how they will go about doing something. The other thing is that the pathways were based on taxonomic or departmental structures. Does this sound familiar? Yeah? So when we might say we want it to be based on animals or something like that, there'd be people inside the museum who would say, no, it must follow this. It must be based on research principles or anything like that. And this concept of taxonomic was quite an interesting one because the Australian Museum has a huge research component at its back end, and that heavily dictates what's going on. So if you want to build a series of portals which may be animal-based, they have to follow taxonomic structure. And you may have heard of this concept of, you know, if you say you don't believe in fairies, a fairy dies. Have people heard that? Let's all clap quickly. Well, the same happens with taxonomy. If you move something out of taxonomic structure, then a scientist dies. So for God's sake, do not ever take anything out of taxonomic structure. For example, what happens is if you decide, for example, that bugs, you want to move them outside this concept of animals or not call them under insects, then scientists have fits. It's just a major drama. And then there's this other thing, which is called silos of information. Have people heard this concept of silos? So basically what happens is you might start at the top of a tree and you might have the Australian Museum, and then you might have animals. And then inside animals, you have a wide variety of animal sort of portals. And inside that, you might have birds. But the problem is once you get into birds, you're in a silo. And how do you jump across to frogs or to something else? So this concept of silos is really limiting in how it can work. And funnily enough, once I looked up what the word silos means, then it means something like rotten vegetable matter in a large container. So how apt is that for this content going on there? So anyway, there we have it. We've got inflexible pathways, problems with this taxonomic stuff and these silos. I want to also talk to you about this pattern that's been repeated before, because a lot of us think that these sort of things we're dealing with in the web are brand new. This is a bit hard to admit, but I've actually worked at the Australian Museum for 20 years. What does that say about me? One, I'm a loser, yes. But two, I'm a very slow learner. Both of them true. But the interesting point here is that a lot of these patterns we're seeing have been done before. Before working on the Australian Museum website, I worked for 12 years doing exhibition design. And the funny thing is that these pressures that we're feeling now in websites have all been fought over in the past with exhibitions. And also, mainly to do with floor plans. So you have this concept of exhibition designers sitting down trying to work out how they're going to structure floor plans. And there's this horrible problem that many floor plans are being written, or concepts for exhibitions, are being written by people who've had academic training. And when you're academic, you can't just be random. You've got to present things in an argument. Does it ring a bell? So you've got to start somewhere, and you've got to go through a path, and then you come to a conclusion. And God help you if you miss one of those steps along the way, because that's how people write essays, that's how people think. It's a Western concept. And when people are writing exhibitions, that's what they wanted to try and do. They wanted to take people on a specific journey. And so if they had a series of panels on walls, the panels would be A, B, C, D. And what their frustration was, they wanted users to move through these exhibitions and look at A first, and then look at B second, C. But of course, what was happening is, when you watched users, and I spent a lot of time watching users, mainly to piss other people off, of course, but what would happen is, people would go to B. They would miss A. Some people would jump to C. Some people would wander around in a daze, a bit of dribble hang out their mouth, and walk out and not look at anything. The problem was that you cannot control users. You cannot control them. And I've actually seen particular exhibitions where they had forced pathways. So they actually literally built barricades. So you had to see A and then B and C. And do you know what they did? People climbed over the barriers. Fuck that, they said. I want to get there. The thing is, you cannot control users. If people come in, there might be something that attracts them more about B than A. You can't control that. People want that freedom. And so the two things that I learned from that experience is, given the choice, people will always follow their own path. Would people agree with that? Yeah? If you have a choice, you'll go the way you want to go, not the way someone else tells you to go, unless you're a slave. And the other thing is that if there's no choice, people will often be resentful. they might not be able to express it, but they'll be resentful on some level. And it can take extreme examples where you see people climb over barricades and just demand that they get over somewhere. So it's ironic that these sort of things, all these lessons that have been learned in exhibition design, haven't been sort of passed on in a lot of ways to the web. And we should be learning from the past. So with all these problems, Lisa and I were sitting down there thinking, this stuff's not working. We've got portals everywhere. We've got forced pathways. We said, wouldn't it be great if we just try something new? And so this ceased to become a museum project. We talked about inside the museum, but a lot of this discussion was outside the museum. And as I said before, it was just a journey we decided to go on where we said, what if we could do this? What if we could do this? And the question we decided was, if we scrap everything and said, how would you organize and structure a large site if you have a totally blank slate? If you didn't have to deal with politics, if you didn't have to deal with, you know, in-house people saying this must go on the site, if you could just focus on the users and try and work out a free way of working through the site. Does that sound like utopia? Yeah? Well, of course it's crap, but... So our first objective was allow users to control and determine their own pathways. So that's our primary objective here. So wouldn't it be cool if instead of coming through things and being forced into portals and then forced down into sections, that users could jump around wherever they wanted on a website? That was a good objective, number one. And so we began with what we called like a strip-back approach. We just forgot all the, you know, the what the design was going to be and just focused on, you know, what are the basic elements of what you wanted. And we came up with three basic pages. Wouldn't it be great if you could break things down to three pages, which is a front page with a search tool, a search result page, and a content page. Pretty simple so far. The problem with that is that you've got three levels instead of 27. Like the museum website, like many big websites, you probably have hierarchy which goes, you know, 15 levels deep. Have people got that problem? 43,000 pages, there's probably people with much bigger websites in this room. And the theory is, if you mapped it out, you'd probably have deeper levels than the museum. But wouldn't it be good if you could break it just down to three levels of pages? And this could be something simple like, you know, having a front page, but the main focus being a search tool, and then getting a result page, which has just a series of links off to pages, and then an example page, for example. The problem was we couldn't work out at first how this metaphor would travel, how we'd actually get to and from these things. And then, of course, tags came into being, and we thought that's the way we want to go. Because what you could suddenly do is, when you're creating a page, instead of using search engines to index the content or, and using this that sort of method, you could actually just attach tags to them. So content creators could add tags to the page, and that would be the way they'd indexed. And so when search results went look for it, it's actually searching for tags rather than this concept of indexed content. And what would come back is tags or the results of tags. And the other thing that's interesting about that is that, and this may be very familiar to people, but the beauty is that what you can do is put on the side of your page related tags. So instead of this concept where you go deep into a bird site and all you get is bird links, you can have related tags and they can be much more open and cross-friendly. And a quick example of that is this concept of bird behavior. It's an example where you might have a topic that a user's searching on. And if you use the traditional metaphor, you would go Australian Museum website, animals, birds, and then searching there for bird behavior. Now, what happens if you come in and you're actually after animal behavior, not bird behavior? So you may want to jump across to say frog behavior or just the broader concept of animal behavior, or even animal feeding, or something that's outside that scope. The problem with this silo effect is that it's very hard to jump outside that metaphor, that we as developers have pushed them into a path. Whereas with keywords, you don't have that sort of lock-in. What can happen is that when you have results on the side, they're related to the keywords. So if you type in bird behavior, not only are you going to get links on the side that are birds, you're also going to pick up the word behavior. So suddenly on the side of your page, instead of this whole hierarchy of bird information, bird links, you would get bird links and behavior links and animal behavior maybe, and maybe even frog behavior if it's there. And it allows users a much more flexible way to move around the website. So that's where we're coming from. The other thing is, wouldn't it be cool if instead of us as content creators putting all these keywords on, that we could allow the users to as well? So you've got these pages here, and at the bottom of every page, you could actually show people what the keywords were and allow people to put in their own keywords. Who think that's a horrendous idea? I've spoken to librarians. Is there any librarians in the room? Because I want to bag you. Damn. Maybe I'll choose another group. Okay, I'm going to bag librarians. Librarians are wonderful people, but and I don't know any of you personally, but they're people that spend their whole life categorizing. Is that true? Yeah? No? What's that? I couldn't hear a word of that, but it sounds great. I'm with you 100%. The point here is, getting back to bagging librarians, the point here is that librarians love to categorize things. So, you know, when a normal human being sees things as, you know, a number of books, I'm sure at home librarians have CD collections that are Dewey system related. Yeah? Alphabetized? Am I on the right track here? Composer-based. But the concept of someone coming in to their CD collection and going, that doesn't go there, I want to put that with this, it's just horrendous. And I've seen people talk, librarians talk about this concept of tagging, and they said, but the users may put the wrong tag word on it. What happens if they put bird? You don't want the word bird on a bird site, it's too obvious. It needs to be something which has value, and we as librarians know about this. Okay, I'm going to stop bagging librarians now, but there is... And it's not just librarians, but there are people who think that it's important that they control the experience for the users, and it's very hard to let go. But the funny thing is that users have their own way of thinking about things. I know it's a hard concept to believe. And when they tag something, it may be really relevant to them. It may also be relevant to 7 million other people that aren't librarians or people that are categorizing it. This concept is very easy to see in Flickr. Hands up those who've been to Flickr. Okay, well, for those that haven't been to Flickr, a lot of the concepts in it are tag-based. You put up images, you can comment on them, and in Australia, there's a strong Flickr community, and the concept is not to actually comment on people's photos, but to abuse them through their photos. And Maxine will tell you about that, because she's one of the... Maxine, by the way, is a Flickr stalker. She admitted this one day when we were talking, and she said, you know, Jeremy Keith had pikelets for breakfast this morning. Now, Jeremy Keith lives in England or Brighton or somewhere, like many, many miles away from Maxine. So it wasn't like she was sitting next to Jeremy Keith at breakfast. Maxine was stalking him. So anyway, enough about Maxine. But the point of Flickr is that Flickr, apart from being voyeuristic and creepy and all those sort of things and the fact that we all love it, that Flickr has this principle of tagging. And it's not based on science. It's not based on librarian CD collections. It's based on users just going, to me, that's relevant. This word's relevant. I'll tag it. And it can be anything. But the thing is, it has meaning for them. And as it builds up, it has meaning for a lot of people. So if you made every single page taggable by users, then everything, every page could actually have different meaning. So there we go, a bit of a rave about that. But the other thing is that you could actually tag any media. So imagine a page ceases to become a normal page and that you could click on an image and tag the image. Or if there was a podcast associated with the page, you'd go and tag the podcast. Or if there was an audio file or a movie file associated with the page, you could tag that. You see in the picture here that suddenly, if you're tagging everything, then everything becomes returnable as a result. So you might get something like a search result that suddenly, instead of when you type in something like birds, you don't just get keyword-based pages that come back, but you might get images and movies and podcasts and audio that come back because all of them have been tagged by not only content providers, but by users. And you can have this tiering effect where, you know, content providers may have more relevance in their keywords if you want, you know, that's a political argument. But the point here is that everything becomes taggable. It ceases to be just a series of locked elements on the page. They all become tags. Holy, that's an interesting approach. I don't know what button I pressed there. Just talk amongst yourself when I get back. Tell me when I'm getting close. Have I gone too far? I've given away all my things. I have to kill you all now. Extended search results. A different page. There we are. See, I'm professional. I'm on the ball. What this brings out, though, is this concept of a very different page. And I don't know about a lot of people who write content, but in a lot of institutions, and the Australian Museum is no exception, when people are writing content, they see them as a series of pages. And that means that with a page, you have images, and they're directly associated with them, and it's all locked and controlled. Whereas with this method, if you start thinking of content is just a tagged element, and images as being just a tagged element, and podcasts or rich media, each of them being just tagged elements, they all come together to create a page. So if you type in something like bird behavior and then click on a result, which is a page, what you may end up with is images coming in which are just related. So instead of content providers directing images that are going on that page, you have images that are being fed in based on keywords. Does that make sense? It's sort of like a very different approach, but pages cease to become in that user sense. And so what you can end up with is pages that are sort of built up with content and then related content, so people can bounce out related images, related podcasts, related movies, related audio files, etc. So a sample page then could become something like this, where you have, you know, related links, and you've got related images and related movies, all that sort of stuff. The pages cease to be pages in the truest sense and just results. What the hell was I going to talk about here? Oh, I've already talked about that, so that's boring. Okay, well, here's an example. So the beauty is that when you've actually moved off a page, you can click on a link to an image, or you click directly on the image itself, and suddenly, in a way, it's its own content. And the beauty is that instead of seeing content based on the page and then an image, you can actually bounce out and look at images. And of course, you can then move off and look at other images. It ceases to be this concept of a page, but also the pages themselves, the images themselves, all their media is associated with it. So it's this, in a way, it becomes a very much more open journey. So then the second objective was to increase communication. The museum, probably like a number of websites, has this sort of authoritative sort of stance, and it's basically, we will tell you, you will listen, or you'll bugger off. Does that sound familiar with people? Yep, pretty familiar. So this concept is that it's a one-way voice. And I'm not bagging the museum. It's a standard practice through a lot of places where your content providers, and you provide the content, and people can look or not look. It's up to them. And it sort of worried Lisa and I a great deal. So we've already talked about this concept of pages being taggable and images being taggable and media being taggable. Wouldn't it be cool as well as that if you could also comment on anything in the website? So you could imagine that you came to a page that you wanted to discuss something, and you could actually type something in and just put it up there. Now, I know what you're thinking. Comment spam? Yeah, that's what you're thinking? Yep. You're thinking people putting up useless things. I know what you're thinking. That's just like my dog. It's going to happen, for sure. The thing is, who are you guys to judge that? You bastards. It might be really relevant to them. The point here is this concept of letting go. So an amazing thing would be able to comment on anything. Might be a pain in the ass, but it might also be quite good. Then we get to this concept of collections, and the museum is obsessed with collections. A lot of government departments know about all this. The museum has thousands and thousands of objects, and there's talk about putting them digitally online. And what that means is you have an image, and then you have a serial number. And believe me, these serial numbers are pretty exciting. SE-607-2-4035Z6, something like that. I know, you're just looking at them makes you excited. And sometimes underneath they may have found Vanuatu. So going well so far, isn't it? But wouldn't it be cool if every single image in the collection could become a communication? So someone may come in and look at that collection image and go, hey, I've got one like that at home. And they could post up their own image or comment on it. And suddenly you have this dialogue going on. And the dialogue can be in multi-level. So the dialogue could just be them commenting back. It could also be scientists or anthropologists, if it's an anthropology collection, communicating with the user. If someone came in and said, I'm not sure, but I have one at home like that, and it's got this on it, and the scientist could go, no, you bought that at Vanuatu, and it was actually at the airport, and it's crap, it's not a real object at all. The interesting thing here is you get this communication going on, but as well as that, you can actually get communication between users. So you may get other users coming in and communicating with each other. So instead of this concept of people talking to the audience and that's it, you can actually possibly have this whole dialogue going on. And then instead of collections being this static thing where you see a page after a page after a page, every single item in the site becomes something that could be a communication tool. And what you end up with is possibly thousands and thousands of little communications going on through a website. It's quite an interesting concept, isn't it? And not new, I'm sure. There's another benefit to this, though, and that's content creation. And what it allows people who are creating content to do is to create content much more quickly. And I've got a little story for you here, because I'm full of parables, and most of them are crap, but this one's actually real. Lisa, at the time we were going through these things, was working on a site called Bugwise. And to create that site, there was a sitemap created, and there was about, you know, 200 pages in it. And so she worked with research scientists, and she wrote some content for it, and then it was put to the scientists who changed it, and then it came back to Lisa who changed it back again, it went back to scientists who changed it back. Does this sound familiar? Yeah? So you have scientists who say, no, you can't say that, and then communicators saying, I can't say that to public, and then, you know, all that sort of stuff going on. But the interesting thing here is that once that exchange is done and everyone's happy, that's one page, and that's put aside, and then you deal with 200 other. Now, of course, it's not that simple, but you've got 200 pages to deal with before you even contemplate getting out into the wild. Whereas, imagine if that could have been changed around. If every single page became a single entity, there's a possibility that Lisa could have worked with a scientist, got that page happening, and published it. Bang, it's up there. And because it's tagged, it doesn't matter. It's not any hierarchy, it's there. Now, it had actually had a real benefit because there was a page we'd been desperately wanting to write for a long time. Can't remember the details, it's something about bugs, but that page we really wanted to get published. And when it went live on the site, it was really important content. But we had to wait like 3 months before that page went live. Whereas if we'd used this sort of much more modular approach, it possibly could have been pumped up that day as soon as that was approved. So there is one fantastic ability that this modular approach does, and that allows much more freedom to publish content. Then we had our third objective, and it's this concept of membership. Now, who finds membership boring as batshit? Oh, okay. The problem I've often uncovered with this membership is it's got agendas going on. And one of the agendas is in the museum. It's in lots of places. I'm not attacking the museum here, but it's trying to get money out of users. People have that? How can we use membership to do one of two things? Revenue raise or spam the bastards? Yeah? Ring a bell? Because really what you're trying to do is get a captive audience so you can start pumping out information about your product. Isn't that a bit malicious? Wouldn't it be good if membership could be used for a much better benefit? And so there are many ways that this could happen, and probably the best example that I can give you is more like the Flickr approach. So imagine if you have this modular approach and people became members. What they could do is travel through the website and comment and all that sort of thing, as we've talked about. But they could also see a page and make it a favorite page. Or if they saw an image in one of the collections, they could make it a favorite. But when they went to their membership page, they had all this stuff at their disposal, just like the Flickr concept. So you could see all the comments you'd made recently and comments that people had made after you. You could see things that you tagged and what you tagged them. And you could actually click through your tags and do things based on those tags. You could also see, did I say keywords? Yeah, tags or keywords that you've done. And you could also see, I've lost the plot, favorites, things like that. Anyway, the bottom line is that you can look at this content in a whole new way, and it allows whole new pathways for people to come in and interact with that content. So it's quite an interesting concept. The other thing is that you could also provide RSS feeds out of various parts of the site and that sort of thing. I just threw RSS in there to make me look more technical. Are you impressed? I like that front. Wow. Downsides. Has anyone uncovered any downsides at the moment? Come on, be brave. I'll let you think about it. I'm going to have a drink. So I want people to start throwing out downsides at me. Or chairs. Come on, give me a downside. Yep, good point. There are numerous downsides. And some of them are this concept of control of keywords, moderating comments. Who think that's a problem? Disparate elements, no clear pathways, no expert voice. Do these ring a bell? Yeah. Funny thing is that they're all true, they're all valid. But most of them revolve around this concept of letting go. And it's sort of quite an interesting subject because in some ways this concept of letting go is, and I hate to use these words, but you've got this concept of Web 1.0 and Web 2.0, and I promise I need to mention Web 2.0 very briefly here. But Web 1.0 is about lockdown. It's about controlling users and locking this and controlling that. And Web 2.0 is about letting go and opening up and opening APIs and letting people do what they want. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. That ring a bell? The thing is, letting go is often about that. And it has multiple uses. But interestingly enough, a long time ago, I went and heard this Buddhist monk talk in Australia, and people were asking him all these questions, and he was being very, you know, wise and all that sort of thing. And then someone said, you know, what's the most important word in the English language? Some hippie, whatever. And the Buddhist monk said, the hardest word for Westerners to say is let. Let it happen. Let it be. And I remember thinking, what a lot of crap is that? But the thing is, over the years, as I've got old, I can see now what he's talking about. I haven't, you know, I'm not enlightened, don't get me wrong, but I have seen where he's coming from. But the bottom line is, what he's really saying is that Westerners are uptight control freaks. Would you agree with that? Look at our cultures. When you're in India, you have yoga and meditation. What do we have in the West? Valium. There's this other concept of expert voice, and it's something that the museum is struggling with all the time. This concept of an expert voice is a fear that information may get out to the public which is incorrect. And it's a huge fear for a research organisation. And by the way, it's completely valid. And it's something that a lot of institutions will wrestle with if they move into any sort of open communication. And I want to give you two little examples of where I think that one of them is failing and one of them is sort of succeeding. And the first one is the Sea Slug Forum. Now, that sounds a bit funny, but if you've ever been involved in sea slugs, this forum is the bee's knees. The sea slug's underpants. The Sea Slug Forum is huge. But ironically, it's not a forum, which is a bit of a problem there. But the Sea Slug Forum is... anyone who's ever seen a sea slug and wants to look at other sea slugs, they could be social divers or hobbyists or scientists, they all go to this Sea Slug Forum. It is the most important resource for sea slug enthusiasts, probably like the Google for sea slugs. The interesting thing is that it also has amazing power. The scientist who runs it, a guy called Bill Rudman, a really cool guy, was telling me one day that he saw a sea slug photo come up online. And he published it and said, I'm not sure of the name of this. And then he drove into work and came into work. And two other scientists around the world had already identified it by the time he got into work. So it's got this beautiful exchange of information. But the big problem with it, apart from the fact it's really not a forum and we're lying and we could be sued for it, is that it's got a one-way exchange. So what happens is people punch messages in and only Bill can respond to them because it has to be scientifically accurate. So Bill has thousands of emails waiting to be published. So what he does is he gets one and he looks at it and he identifies the sea slug, and he will write a really resounding message back. And these will come out as a series of messages. But the problem here is it's all driven by Bill. If Bill were to die, there would be no sea slug for him, which would be very sad, not only for Bill, but for sea slugs in general. The problem here is this one-way communication. There's no interchange, and even more importantly, there's no ownership. So these people, even though they really love sea slugs, they don't interact in a much more meaningful way. And there have been times when we've said, wouldn't it be better just to allow the comments to go out without you having to look at each one and respond to them officially? And the unanimous response has always been, no, I cannot let them go out because the information may be false. Have people had that before? Yeah? And then you look at something like a mail list, and the Web Standards Group mail list is a classic example. The Web Standards Group mail list. Now there's a social interchange. If we could... hands up those who are on the mail list. Because I've bagged librarians, and now I'm going to bag all of you. If you could, break the group down, if you put every single human being in the Web Standards Group together and homogenize them into one human being, what would they be? Psychotic. Would they be white? Would they be male? Would they be young? Would they be socially inept? How can I say that with a group I started? I love the Web Standards Group. It's a beautiful thing. But Jesus Christ, some of the interchange there. I think that on any mail list, there should be this form about how to interact socially. Do people agree? It's a bit of a problem there. So commonly what you get is someone puts up something and another person will come in and say, that is crap. It's a good way to exchange. I've often wondered what this sort of thing would happen if they did that sort of thing at parties. Imagine that sort of person at parties. Hi, how are you? I'm good. I vote for the Liberal Party. They are just bastards. You don't know what you're talking about. That's just shit. Imagine how much social life you'd have if you carried on like that. People would be inviting you to lots of parties. Let's bring him along. But anyway, that's not the point of all this. The point of all this is this concept of peer review. Peer review is something that scientists use. So when a scientist publishes a paper, and I only know this very vaguely, so if there's scientists in the room, like our librarians, come up and see me afterwards and knee me in the balls if you want. When scientists go to publish something, they can't just put it out there. They can't just say, thylacines are alive again, I found one, blah. They have to go through peer review, which means they have to send it off to other scientists. And I think there's normally three scientists, three independent, recognised scientists, have to look at that and go, my God, thylacines are alive. I can see from that photo. That's not blurry and... Yeah, anyway, you know what I mean. So scientists review, and then if it's reviewed and approved by all three, it gets published. So there's this very different metaphor to the web. The web is based on pumping stuff up and, you know, let it be. But the interesting thing is, what happens if you let go? What happens if you gave that control back to the user? And the Web Standards Group is just one list where you can see that going on. What you end up happening is that you have community review. So if someone publishes a question and someone else writes back and says, the answer is blah, it may be wrong. Do people immediately look at Peter and I, who started the list, and go, that list is just shit? The answer is yes, but that's for another reason. The thing is, people don't judge the list. They see it as a community. In a community, people have different opinions. The other thing is, almost immediately, someone will step in and say, that's wrong. And we know that they'll actually say that because they're socially inept and they can't say it in nice ways, but they do help each other. It's a beautiful, helpful tool. People help each other, but they also peer review. Very quickly, you get the answer. But something else happens, which is quite interesting. You get to learn along the way. Now, when Bill Rudman sort of vetoes stuff on the way through and then publishes it, no one learns about the mistakes on the way through. Whereas if you're looking at the Web Standards Group mail list and someone says, this is blah, and you go, oh, okay, that's blah, and then someone comes and goes, actually, it's not blah at all, you actually go, oh, actually, you know, it's a bit of a shock, and you actually learn from the process. And instead of just one person learning, when Bill writes to them off list and says, you know, that CSLUG is not what you thought it was, it's this, imagine if that exchange had happened online. Everyone would have learned about it. So the advantages are that peer review can actually be, community peer review can in some ways be more powerful and almost as accurate, if not as accurate, as expert peer review. So sometimes this concept of expert voice may not be as problematic as we think. The other thing is that imagine you publish a page as content providers and people start commenting on it underneath. There's absolutely no reason why you can't flag scientists who respond in comments in a different way. Have people seen blogs where authors' comments are flagged in a different way? Yeah? So when you see a whole series of comments under a blog post, there might be one by the author and it's in a different colour and has their photo or something, you know, and it's actually obviously different. So people, when they're reading through, they'll know that the person who's written that blog has actually responded. And if you use the same with scientists, what it would allow them to have is you'd have this community comments, but when a scientist stepped in and said, well, actually, that's not quite correct, it should be this way, then people could actually take it, you know, depending on the value merit of scientists, could take it as more important or at least realise that that's an expert talking about the subject. So there are ways you can actually make this expert voice still ring true. The last concept that I want to talk about is this concept of site mourning. And what it is when I've talked about this concept to people, there's a lot of people that go, oh, it's not a website. They normally shrink their body like that too. It's like this. It's mourning. They're mourning for a website. For some people, a website is a story. It's not a series of pages. They'd hate this. They'd probably crucify me. If it was back in the Dark Ages, I'd be a witch and I'd be burned. And, you know, that's cool because I can withstand fire. But the thing here is that there are some people who like a story, and that's valid. The people like an argument, and they like to go from A to B to C, etc., and move on. But the question is, does everyone like that? And as people building websites, you then have to weigh up the benefits of both. If a large percentage of a community felt website mourning and wanted to have a story told that way, then obviously you wouldn't jump into this approach and, you know, break everything up and yell and scream and take your underpants off. But if it suited the content, it may be that that is a marginalized aspect and it's not important. The thing that I found most intriguing, though, is the people who experience website mourning most are content creators. How weird is that? Because they're often people who've come from academic side and they see themselves as wanting to tell a story in a full and complete way. Of course, it's horrendous for them to think that people come in via Google and go in, grab content and leave. It's a horrendous concept. If they could grab everyone that came in and staple them to their web pages and force them to read the whole concept, they would. Google is probably the enemy of these people. Anyway, I'm bagging them out. It's a completely valid concern, but again, it's something to weigh up. So what have we learned today? One, I'm a raving lunatic, given. Two, we've talked a bit about tag-based pathways. Pages can become a series of entities. We talked about commenting communities, membership, downsides, upsides. Is this valid? Who knows? As I said at the beginning, I'm not trying to present a solution here. What I was very intrigued with is that when Lisa and I went through this process, it was quite fun. We're just exploring ideas, and as soon as you actually sit down and put these in real situations, you uncover flaws in them based on your own needs, and there's probably millions of flaws in them. And each website would probably have flaws that would make this improbable or impossible, but wouldn't it be cool if we could move that direction? There's some benefits in it. Would people agree there's benefits? Yeah? So anyway, this is a journey we undertook. The journey's still going. The museum still hasn't moved on, and it's not because this way is a better or worse way. The museum is still exploring its own ways. Lisa and I just went off on a tangent and explored something for ourselves, and I thought I'd share it with you today. Thank you for your time. Now, I've been asked if... 5 minutes. I've been asked if people want to ask questions. To be honest, I don't want to answer anything because there's so many flaws in this argument. But if people want to ask me a question, I'll pretend that I'll know the answer and look intelligent up here. I can't hear anything, by the way. Look, before we go on, I should just, and this is absolutely true, I'm slightly deaf. And I'm getting... So, can we get a mic up there? Sorry about the, it's not anything personal.
Hi.
Hey.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
Can you talk more about your experience with exhibit design and the user experience and the things you observed about people's behavior and parallels to web design?
Yeah, I'd have to. That I feel quite comfortable talking about, strange enough. What I can tell you about is a giant octopus. A long time ago, the museum put on an exhibition called Sex, which we thought, my God, everyone on earth will come to. But it turns out that the exhibition was talking about animal sex for a start, which really marginalized a lot of people. But funnily enough, had this gigantic octopus, an inflatable octopus in the ceiling. That's quite an odd thing to do. And I don't know what it had to do with sex, but maybe for octopus bestialis, it might have been value. But the point here is that we did a lot of watching of people going through the exhibition. And what was interesting is that evaluation came into play here. And what came out of the evaluation, now this is a bit of an attack on people who do evaluation now, is that the octopus had no value. Because when people were asked about it, they said, oh, I didn't see that. So, you know, it had no value, therefore it must be scrapped. The interesting thing here is that when you look in an exhibition, it's a three-dimensional space and it's got masses of context and it's virtually impossible to analyse people's reaction to things. And when I was talking before about people moving to panel A and panel B and things like that, if you ask people about it, they'd find it very hard to articulate what was going on. And this concept of the octopus, a lot of people weren't absolutely realising it was there, but the reality, it added to the experience. So it actually sort of uncovered some flaws in this concept of hard-based evaluation. But the other thing that was interesting about it is we actually forced some scientists to watch the evaluation process, to actually observe people using things. And one I can clearly remember was this concept of tooth replacement. We did this exhibition on spiders, sharks. And I don't know whether people know this concept that sharks replace teeth, yeah? So we had no money. We were going to do this, you know, wild interaction. And so instead we had a circle with some teeth on it, and you could turn it around, it would show that teeth would sort of replace. highly technical. And anyway, the point here is that the scientist was adamant that people would read the text first and then play with the toy. Hands up those who agree with him. He was adamant. No one on earth would just go up and play with the toy and not read the text. And of course, what happened? People walked up and walked off. He was in tears. He was in tears. And anyone asked what it was, they said, fucked if I know. The thing is that this concept of pathways was being, you know, the scientist learned something. He actually came up and he said, I learned that lesson. This concept that people will do something that you expect. But exhibition design is fraught with examples of where people, you know, build something and expect something and people do the exact opposite. So, does that help? And that blue octopus is gone, by the way. Any other questions?
In connection with special labels for scientists and so forth on forums, what do you think of mutual rating of reputation of users by other users?
Yeah. Yeah, there's whole communities that are based on that, that their responses become rated and people's expertise are community-driven. Yeah, it's a very valid one. There's one behind you.
How are you actually going to get the Australian Museum to build something like this? I mean, it's all very good to talk about it with a group of web designers, but for these things to go ahead, you actually need the big companies with all their vested interests and stuck in their ways of thinking to agree.
I've got to go now, bye. It's true. It's a really hard thing. This concept of website mourning is experienced by the museum on many levels. Number one, I don't want to start bagging the museum because it's a podcast and I'm still an employee, or at least I am till I get back home. But it is a hard concept, and there's a reluctance to move away from things anyway. And in Australia, there's this concept of, there's a word I'm thinking about, but it's gone, of covering your butt. In a lot of government departments, if you were to talk about something incredibly radical, any government institution is going to lock down. Their sphincters are going to close up. It's a natural reaction. And yes, when we talked about it, people were intrigued, but not sort of like, that's great, let's embrace it. So the path is still ongoing. It may be that just some aspects of this are taken in. So it may be that some pages are allowed to comment, or we do something small in the corner and gradually, you know, that it moves into that. I have seen sites that have embraced this. After Lisa and I did this, I came across a site in Australia. I think it's called Rummage. I don't know whether people have seen it, but that site has actually embraced it fully. And sometimes, as you all know, commercial people can move much quicker than governments because they don't have this, you know, this lockdown. And so the museum may move that way. It may not ever move that way. To us, it was more just, you know, let's explore how it could go. And wouldn't it be great if one day we could move that way ourselves? It may not be on the Australian Museum site. It may be that the people in here go, cool, and introduce something like that well before, you know, the museum ever gets it up and running. So it's a very valid comment that the museum may never get there. Final question? Because I think we're up. Final question. I don't know, it's from a librarian.
How do you organise your CD collection?
I have an iPod. Thank you very much.
I should mention Russ had 3 weeks to prepare with Roger their workshop, their whole one-day workshop, and this presentation. It showed, but well done.